tonight on Arena. Tara Erocht and Jaime Martin on their upcoming performance at the National Concert Hall. And Louise McSharry asks, where do I begin with Swedish singer Robin? #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. This Friday, May the 28th, the RTE National Symphony Orchestra live series continues with another concert streamed from the National Concert Hall in Dublin. Chief Conductor Jaime Martin and the RTE National Symphony Orchestra promise an evening of, quote, high emotion, passion and carefree pleasure from three masters of melody. Those masters being Gustav Mahler, Felix Mendelssohn and Erich Korngold. The music featured from Korngold comprises a series of songs he wrote quite remarkably in his mid-teens just about a century ago, and they will be brought to us live on the evening by mezzo-soprano Tara Erocht. And delighted to have Jaime and Tara join me on the programme this evening. It's the masters of melody bit really there, Jaime. That must have been what set you off in choosing these, not only these three composers, but I think the three works that you've chosen as well. Melody was at the very front of your mind, I think.
Well, of course, melody, as you well said, it is a very important part of this concert. But actually, you know, the first piece we had for this program was the Korngold, and we created the program around this piece. And when you listen to these amazingly beautiful melodies and brings you to the world of Strauss or something, I thought we really have to start the program with the Adagietto from Mahler's Symphony Number 5, which is it is quite an extraordinary piece, as you probably know. And then we decided to finish with Mendelssohn. There is a connection between the three composers. There are three Jewish composers, and an extraordinary connection between Korngold's simple songs we will play and the Mendelssohn Symphony Number 1. This piece by Korngold was written when he was, as you say, in the mid-teens, when he was 14. And the Mendelssohn Symphony Number 1 was written when Mendelssohn was 15 years old, which is absolutely incredible. So we have an example of incredibly precocious genius.
Absolutely, yeah. Mendelssohn was an old fella by comparison to Korngold, however, when you compare the two pieces. It is extraordinary, Tara, that it was a teenager who gave us these Korngold, these songs.
Absolutely. Good evening, gentlemen. And these are incredible songs. What was so interesting for me, obviously, I've spent an amount of time, you know, living in the German-speaking countries, and I work often in Vienna. And you can really hear how when he was growing up, there was so much other really rich composition happening. You know, I mean, he was a child when Mahler, when Strauss, when they were really on fire. Incredible. And we also know now that even people like Puccini was aware of Korngold as a child. I mean, they're really the genius that's held within the songs. I'll tell you, there's very little einfach about them when you try to learn them.
I was going to say that einfach, sesh einfach lieder, six simple songs. When I see the word simple written beside music, I think this is not going to be simple at all. They are not simple.
Of exaggerations. Well, I mean, I have to say where I find the real genius is that he's written so incredibly fluently and well for the voice. He was a really brilliant pianist himself. So, of course, we expect the melodies and all of the orchestration to be intricate and interesting. But how he wrote for the voice was really masterful, always with really beautiful and natural vowels and never putting you under too much stress. And that, I suppose, is the einfach part for me, that the voice can just do it. But the actual learning of the tones was an interesting an interesting period, to say the least.
And quite definitely not einfach. Right, let's have a listen to the a little section from the, I particularly like this, and I think you chose this, I think, as well as one of your favourites from the cycle, Tara, is the sixth and final song, Summer.
Yes.
And God knows we all want a little bit of summer, don't we? What kind of summer does Korngold give us?
A really, really lush one. One that is well beyond his years. And when we hear how gooey and wonderful the middle section especially gets, he brings us up almost to an Irish summer where, you know, they hint all the time at great weather. but he has to send us back to our dreams and our imagination when he brings back the harp and we can have our beautiful summer in our dreams.
All right, well, let's have a listen to a little bit of Summer, one of the songs that Tara Rocks will be singing on Friday evening at the National Concert Hall. I just wanted to let that little bit, that long note and those harp notes play in there, because we'll explain why when we talk about the Mahler piece in a second. But that is extraordinary music and absolutely beautiful. If we have a summer like that, we'll be doing well. That's the sixth and final of the six simple songs of Eric Korngold. Tara Rocht will be singing it. That was a performance by Barbara Hendricks. Tara Rocht will be singing it with the RT National Symphony Orchestra on Friday evening, live from the National Concert Hall, streamed live on rte.ie/culture and broadcast on RT Lyric FM. Jaime, he wrote those songs at the piano and they were subsequently orchestrated, but I wanted to get to that little bit where we hear the little pluck of the harp. Is that a direct quote from the Mahler Adagietto that we're about to listen to about and that you'll also be playing on the evening? Is it exactly the same piece of music?
Well, actually, you know, it is, I haven't thought of that, you know, but of course, having the harp in this moment with the strings and the melody, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, with the proximity of the two pieces, that is completely inspired by that. And it is the same kind of sound world. And that's why I wanted to play the Mahler before, but I'm sure they are completely related.
Yeah, there's certainly something in my ear that just jumped out at me the minute I heard it. So let's go to that Adagietto. It's a piece of music that people will know, particularly from the world of cinema, the Adagietto from the Symphony No. 5 from Death in Venice. And of course, it was played at the funeral of Kennedy, wasn't it, in the 1960s. It was one of the pieces that really stood out for people. This is purely strings that we get in this piece, Jaime.
I think this is the piece is written for strings and harp. But I think these are strings that want to sound like human voice. I mean, I think it's, as you said at the beginning, it's melodies, it's singing, it's actually it's moaning. This is a piece with absolute amazing feel of reflection. It's sadness together with hope, and I think this is an extraordinary piece. Always makes me cry listening to this piece. I don't know if it's the same for you, but
well, I've got my hanky out now. You better get your hanky out as well. I don't know if you need the hanky or not, Tara, but I would suggest having one on standby. Had to get to the big drama. There were no small dramas, I would guess, Jaime Martín, in the Mahler household, if we're to go by the Adagietto from the Symphony No. 5. It's such lush dramatic. And if you wanted to sit down, as I sometimes know people who did in their mid-20s and had feel sorry for themselves over whatever romantic entanglement that was going wrong on them, that's great music to cry to, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's like luxurious pain.
purely luxurious pain. It struck me listening to it, Tara Arach. I'm sure you have sung Mahler, obviously, I think, along the way. But wouldn't that be a fantastic vocalese, you know, that melody line to soar out above an orchestra just singing on an A sound or on a vowel sound? It'd be lovely to hear, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Without a question. I mean, Mahler does pain like very few other people. And he does it always on open, beautiful vowels that he makes it like a visceral, it comes from your gut. So, I mean, oftentimes you hear an amazing piece like that and you think, oh Lord, couldn't he have put me in there on a nice ah in the background somewhere, you know?
Well, I was thinking as I listened, it should really be sung that, you know, because I'm sure, I wonder, is there a vocalese arrangement of it? The third piece on the evening then, Jaime, will be Mendelssohn's Symphony Number 1. Again, we've chosen a section from this that is pretty much gets, whoops, no, stop that, Sean. A section which has pretty much got melody to the fore as well. It's a little bit into the third movement of the symphony. Let's have a listen and you can tell us a little bit about it afterwards. Given a little swing of that one, just to give a sense that the melody on the clarinet in that particular, again, a vocal sound very much to the fore, Jaime Martin.
Well, the thing is that Mendelssohn Symphony Number 1 is not very often played. Actually, it's not a very well-known piece. But for me, the trio of the scherzo, which is what you just played, it is something about this moment that I think opens my heart, makes life worth living. I mean, it is like an anthem of hope. I don't know. It is like almost like a Thanksgiving moment. I love this moment. I cannot wait to start working tomorrow with the orchestra and to arrive to the trio of the scherzo and hear the wonderful RT National Symphony Orchestra of Ireland playing this. I just cannot wait.
Yeah, and that will be the final piece in the concert, that full symphony. You'll start the evening out with the Adagietto from Symphony Number 5, the Mahler piece that we heard a little bit of there. And then the evening will start out with the songs, or sorry, in the middle will be the songs of the six simple songs, not simple at all, as Tara Rox has been telling us, of Eric Korngold. And Tara, just while you are there, I noticed a big tweet on your Twitter handle. Was it last night? I'll give the first bit and you can continue and tell us what it is. Guess who's making a big, in capital letters, debut next season? Who? Is it Tara Arach?
Imagine. It is. And this was a hard secret to keep because, you know, as it goes in our industry, you take contracts 3 and 4 years in advance. And with COVID and everything else, you just could not be getting your hopes up. But finally, things are on the up and the theatres are reopening. And I will be going to the National Opera in Paris next February to sing the title role in Massenet's Cendrillon. So adding another Cinderella to my bow.
Yeah, you've a few Cinderellas under your belt at this stage, don't you? And the Massenet one, are we in the world of a kind of French melody here, I'm presuming?
And it's stunning. It's really kind of outside of the realms. I've done the Rossini one now nearly 50 times. This is so very different and also a slightly different take on the fairy tale itself, where there's, you know, there's the shoe and all those other wonderful things. It's actually never been performed in the National Opera in Paris, which is quite something. And to be given that as a foreigner is also, I mean, they've put a lot of trust in me. But I'm so excited to kind of step foot in this music. It's a new repertoire for me and a big new step for the voice. So yeah, great times.
That's very exciting. Well, congratulations on that, and looking forward
Thank
to hearing
you.
More about it. I'm sure we'll talk about it closer to the time. And Jaime, a little bit of forward plans from you, if you wouldn't mind as well. June, you have plans around the Beethoven project, the Arte Beethoven project in June?
Yes, and this is very, very exciting. The European Arts Channel, Arte, is creating this European celebration of Beethoven, which will be 9 symphonies in 9 cities. And one of the orchestras and cities chosen for this event was Ireland and the Arte National Symphony Orchestra. So this will be on Sunday, the 6th of June. Will be shown on this European channel Arte, and also on RT1 at exactly at 2:10 in the afternoon.
Yeah. And also which, Lyric FM. Which of the 9 symphonies will we be hearing from the RT National Symphony Orchestra?
We will perform Symphony Number 2.
On the same day,
it will be like a Beethoven marathon. I think we are in a very fantastic company. One of the symphonies, number one, will be the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, the Vienna Symphony, the Finnish Radio Symphony, the Czech National Orchestra. So I think we are in very good company. So we are very excited to be part of this project.
In the meantime, the both of you will be in great company on Friday evening when you're in each other's company. Jaime Martín, conductor of the RT National Symphony Orchestra, and mezzo-soprano Tara Arocht. Thanks to both of you for being with us this evening. And that performance on Friday evening, Mahler, Korngold and Mendelssohn, well worth listening into if you get a chance, or we can watch it on the telly in a couple of Sundays' time as well. But at any rate, you can stream it live, RT National Symphony Orchestra live this Friday, streamed live from the National Concert Hall in Dublin, streamed on rte.ie/culture and broadcast live on RTE Lyric FM. Now this evening, for Where Do I Begin, we consider the career of the Swedish singer and performer Robin, first coming to prominence in the late 1990s. She was a pop contemporary of the likes of All Saints and the Spice Girls, and she achieved international success with singles like Show Me Love, which charted in the US Billboard Top 10. And a bit like the composers we were just talking about, she was still only a teen when her early success happened. Considering her output, however, in the last 10 years, which has seen her transform into a fiercely independent artist, determinedly ploughing her own creative furrow, while at the same time producing monster synth-pop hits like The Heartbreaking With Every Heartbeat, Dancing On My Own, and the album's Body Talk, more recently Honey, it's fair to say that Robin has truly evolved from her commercial pop beginnings and has been described as a pop artist with a knack for alchemizing heartbreak into pure energy, which is what we've just been talking about again about other composers. Joining me now to consider the work of Robin is the 2FM presenter Louise McSherry. When we asked you, Louise, about coming on the show to do one of our Where Do I Begin slots, you knew immediately it was straight away it was going to be Robin. Why is she such an important artist to you personally, Louise?
I think it's funny, it was only in considering her work for this conversation that I kind of drew all the lines together, because I first grew to really love Robin with her 2008 album, Robin, and I just absolutely loved it. It was an incredible album. I loved every note of it. It felt very true. And I remember driving through the wilds of Connemara, listening to With Every Heartbeat on repeat, like feeling every inch of it. I wasn't heartbroken, but I felt like I could have been. And I went to see her that year. She played in what was then The Village in Dublin. And the gig, I don't think any gig has ever had such an impact on me. I remember afterwards just kind of leaning on the wall of the venue and feeling like I couldn't stand up nearly. Like, it had been so brilliant, so incredible. She's such an incredible live performer. So at the beginning, it was really just about the music and the performance. But then as the years went on, and I suppose I grew and she grew, and the more I learned about her and the more music she released, the more I respected her and admired her, because she makes unbelievable pop songs. I mean, they are the catchiest of songs, but she's also a fiercely independent artist. Like, she is a pop artist with indie sensibilities in the truest sense. You know, she started out with a very commercial career, and then she wasn't happy with her creative control, so she started her own record label and started releasing music on her terms that is written by her and produced by her. She never seemed to have any real interest in being pretty, even though she was pretty. She was just like achingly cool in the way that I think Swedish people have a particular
knack
for.
Can't they?
they do.
Yeah, just because I want to play a little bit of With Every Heartbeat, but she has to travel a bit of a distance before she gets to there, really, because that early period, as you say, it was very, she was still a teenager when she first came to prominence. Was it a very different Robin that was there as a teenager? Was it that she was being moulded, or had she just not developed more into the artist that she now is?
Well, it's funny because I don't actually think it was a very different Robin. Like, she co-wrote all the songs on her first album, and she still, you know, when she does gigs, she still sings Show Me Love, and you know, she does a kind of more acoustic version of it, but she certainly doesn't feel detached from that early artist. But she was a co-writer and she was with a big label, and then it seemed like they wanted to keep her in that kind of good girl, you know, teenage. They wanted her to kind of act her age, as it were. And she was quite a sophisticated young person because she grew up with a family of performers and she had been traveling with them as a kid. So she didn't feel, from everything I've read, you know, I won't speak for her, but she didn't feel like a 15, 16, 17 year old. And it was the pressure on her, I think, to perform and to kind of be a Christina Aguilera type that just didn't feel true to her. And she started to kind of have more of, as her own artistry developed, wasn't in sync with the record label. You know, she had signed with Jive Records and she worked with the Swedish artists The Knife on a song called Who's That Girl, which is a really iconic Robin song because it's all about independence and owning your own space. But, and when she played it for the record label, they didn't like it. And that was when she thought, okay, I have to,
time for me
I can't, then. If they don't like this, I don't want to be
out
here.
Yeah, well, let's start then with our Where Do I Begin aspect of things, because this is where you began with her as well, with that song, With Every Heartbeat. Let's have a listen. We talk a little bit further about it afterwards. Every Heartbeat there from Robin, and Robin is the artist for whom Louise McSherry is answering the question this evening, Where Do I Begin With? And that is the big starting point for you. Is it almost like a kick-starting the career again for Robin when we get that album, Robin Is Here, in 2005, and that song being one of the big hits off it, Louise?
Yes, definitely. Like, the period between her first album and that was kind of a bit murky. There were, you know, albums that were released only in Sweden and, you know, EPs that were only released in America. And it was just a bit messy. She wasn't happy. The record label didn't seem to be happy. So, you know, things weren't really going so well. But that's her first release on her album, Konnichiwa Records, you know, where she really had total ownership over it. And it is so brilliant. I mean, every single track on that album is good. And I mentioned...
And even that section in the middle there, when it goes into the big string arrangement, and maybe that was what the labels weren't allowing her to do, do you think?
I mean, possibly, but I think it was almost the tone and the content of her songs. But yeah, she's heavily involved in the production as well. And, you know, when she first was working on the songs for this album, there were some, you know, the one of the people she was working with was suggesting guitars, and she was like, no, I'm not making a guitar album. I want strings. I want synths. And that lush, rich sound is definitely one of the things that drew me into that song. And I have listened to that at least 1,000 times, and I do not get sick of a single note. It's just, it's a perfect song. And it also sets her out as the queen of the sad banger, which is certainly, I think, what she's become. You know, she knows how to make these incredible songs about, like, you know, really difficult heartbreak, but make them songs that you are dancing to somehow. And I don't think anyone does it better than her.
Yeah, so it was a kind of a dance though your heart is breaking type of feel off of it.
Yeah.
What the Body Talk series of albums then that started about 4 or 5 years after Robin Is Here, the album from which we got With Every Heartbeat. What are we talking about in the Body Talk series?
So that was really interesting because what happened was she released Body Talk, which is now, if you go to a streaming service, it's one album. But at the time, she released it as three mini albums. And she basically, it seems like she was just really enthusiastic. She had her creative freedom. She had her own label. She could do what she wanted. She said, I have all these songs. I might as well just release them, which actually, in my opinion, is real kind of forward thinking, because these days artists are really examining the way that they release their music and they're not so kind of slave to the idea of releasing an album and singles and all the rest. You know, they all came out kind of in quick succession, these albums, and the songs are brilliant. They're very much in the same kind of style as Robin, not a huge change in style, which I was absolutely delighted about. I remember getting my hands on them and just being so thrilled, and so thrilled at the idea of three mini albums as opposed to one. You know, you could really draw it out, and the songs are just brilliant and fun. I mean, that's the thing about Robin. She incorporates a bit of, like, you know, she has a real swagger. There's a bit of hip hop in there in the Body Talk series, and in Robin, and she's just, there's loads of fun. They're fun songs with the heartbreak as well, obviously.
Yeah, well, she's able to have fun and that heartbreak and that bit of a laugh at herself as well, if you like, in the midst of this song, I think, which is called Dancing on My Own. You know, to be fair, there is a bit of heartbreak in there as well, Louise McSharrier, isn't there, in Robin and that song, Dancing on My Own, from the Body Talk series?
There is. There sure is. And, you know, that song, that album also has Call Your Girlfriend on it, or that series has Call Your Girlfriend on it, which is another one. But she also, the opener of that is this song called Don't Effing Tell Me What to Do, which is just so powerful. And that's, I think, at the root of all of her music, there is this feminism that's, you know, she doesn't have to overtly say it, but it's just there. And I think that's actually one of the things that I always connected to. That song, Dancing on My Own, was featured in Girls. And that, I think, gave her a real kind of resurgence of popularity. And then,
in the television series, was it?
The television series Girls. And then actually at the very end of that series, Robin provided an early version of Honey from her latest album, which was really exciting, because so many people had connected to her music through the series Girls, it made sense that it was there in the season finale.
I'll come back to Honey, but just to stick around the period of the Body Talk series for a moment, if I could, Louise, she embarked on a very intense psychoanalysis around this time. Obviously, very deeply personal experience for her. Mm. What do you think that was about? When you consider how long she's been in the business, I suppose, signing to RCA when she was just 15, was it linked into her professional experience, or do we know what was involved there?
Well, there were a few things going on. So she broke up with her long term partner, who actually she ended up getting back together with a few years later, and they're still together now. But also, she lost her friend and collaborator Christian Falk, who was someone who she'd worked with from her very early music days and who had become a great friend and collaborator. And, you know, their relationship seems to have been very, very deep and very special. And in fact, one of my favorite Robin songs is not a Robin song at all. It's a Christian Falk song featuring Robin, which is called Dream On. So if people are listening and they haven't heard that, I can't recommend it enough. So she had this relationship breakdown. She lost someone very important to her creatively and personally. And then also, you know, it seemed like she had a lot to process in terms of what had happened in her 20s and in her teens. And it seems to me like she just needed a break. Now, she told the New York Times that she was really having a hard time. And there were days where she was only getting out of bed to go and get a coffee or go to therapy. But it seems to have been very important for her, and she seems to have come out of it, you know, much the better for it.
And then I suppose subsequent to that, and maybe it was part of the recovery process, in 2018, we got the release of Honey then. She described it, in fact, herself, I think, as a diary in grief, and all about referring to Christian Falk, her friend, as you said, who had died for. Do we still get? Is this a very nuanced form of sadness on the dance floor, if you like, that we get in Honey, or is it a different Robin from the other two Robins we've been listening to?
I think it's a little bit more nuanced, but Robin's lyrics are always fairly straightforward. You know, you can really hear literal mentions of grief and of missing, like Missing You is the first single from that album, and obviously that is about missing someone, and it's, you know, she has said it's about both the relationship and the loss of Christian Falk. So it's a little bit more nuanced, I think, and a little bit more subtle. The tone isn't so kind of punch you in your face pop, although there are pop moments on there. It's definitely an evolution, but you know, she's 41 now. She was nearly 40 when she released that. And she's not a teenager anymore. She's still making brilliant pop music, but it's a little bit more grown up, I think. And I absolutely love it.
So if you had to say what it is about Robin, I can see why she got you back in the day with those with those big dance floor numbers in some ways. How has she held on to you, and how has she developed in an artist? I suppose I'm looking at what has she given to the pop world?
Well, I think, you know, what she has given to the pop world is really smart, never apologetic pop. She's always done things on her own terms. And I think she's been a real kind of icon for other artists. You know, the young Swedish pop artist Zara Larsson mentioned that, you know, Robin was very much someone who she looked up to. And you can hear Robin in lots of pop releases. I mean, you can literally hear her in a Britney Spears track from some years ago, and then you can hear covers. Callum Scott, this British artist, did a cover of Dancing on My Own a few years ago and had absolutely enormous success. Very frustrating for me personally. I did not rate that cover, but it's because the song itself is so brilliant. You know, she's given us these brilliant songs, but I think why I connect to her, you know, on a deeper level beyond the music, is that, you know, she has been so herself and so unapologetic. She has never let anyone put her in any place. You know, if she wanted to take a break, and she took basically her 30s off from music, and she did that, and she kept us waiting. And, you know, the appetite for her work was enormous. No one forgot about her during that period. You know, everyone was dying for more Robin, because what she does is very special. Right. It's so special. And as a young woman, you know, having someone a few years older than me, you know, making music that I loved, but with an attitude that meant even more to me, you know, it's something that I'll never forget, and I'll always be craving more Robin.
Well, listen, thanks for sharing your thoughts on Robin with us this evening. Laura, that would really, really open my mind up to her music at any rate. And we'll finish up with the title song from that 2018 song, it's the 18 album, Honey. Louise McSharry, thanks for being with us, Louise.
Thank you.
Honey, the title song from the 2018 album of Robin. Honey, obviously the title of that album as well. And it was Louise McSharry who asked and answered the question for us this evening: where do I begin with Robin? Clothes are information, says English fashion writer Charlie Porter as he trains his eye on painters, sculptors and photographers in his new book, What Artists Wear. Artists can wear what they like to work, he argues, whether it's Gilbert and George, whose trademark tweed suits belie the fun and colour and sheer loudness of their art, or sculptor Barbara Hepworth, freer than most women in the 1950s to wear boiler suits. And what does their choice of attire reveal? Vari Claffey has been reading the book What Artists Wear for us, and she joins me this evening. Give me a little bit of background, if you would, first of all, Vari, on Charlie Porter.
Well, Charlie Porter wanted to become a fashion writer but couldn't afford fashion college. He wanted to study at Chelsea. And so instead he became a researcher and started writing for The Express and went on to become a fashion journalist and an art journalist and to write about art and then also to curate exhibitions. So his you know, he says he's not so much interested in fashion as he is interested in clothing and dress, really. And that's how he comes to approach this project, What Artists Wear.
Yeah, it is very interesting that, because when I heard the title of this book, First What Artists Wear, and when we were talking about the item, I thought, oh, this will be a big hardback book and I'll be looking through loads of pictures. But in fact, this book is very much, yes, there are plenty of illustrations in it, it's paperback size, but it's driven by the words and by the thoughts around what we're looking at as much as it is by the images themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. The images are more like a kind of documentation or a kind of testimonial for his relationship to the artists and their relationship to their clothes. So the images appear and they do sort of demonstrate what he's talking about. But there's a real quietness to the book. And he talks about artists and eccentricity and the sort of usefulness of flamboyance and eccentricity. But there's a lot also about a more workaday, quiet relationship, like developed, intense relationship with clothing.
Yeah,
and the way that artists use it. Yeah.
And quite definitely, everyday clothing is part of that. But there is one big exception. Maybe we'll start with the exception, if you like. Louise Bourgeois, one of the few artists who we're talking about, real high-end fashion. He goes to visit her house in New York, which has been preserved as it was during her lifetime. What kind of flavour does he give of that particular place to us?
It's a real pilgrimage that he goes. So there's a mixture between the work, the clothing that Bourgeois had, again, making a kind of uniform. She'd have two fur coats. They were worn time and time again. She comes from a background of tapestry. So her interest in stitching and fabric is very long term. It's kind of relationship that goes back to her family. But also clothing as protection comes from that time. There was a big wound in the family when her father had an affair with the minder. And she used clothing, she says, to cover a wound. And she keeps for a very long time a rail of clothing in her house. And sometime after her husband dies, the clothing moves. You know, she's 83 at this point, but the clothing moves out of her house and into the studio. And as it's becoming kind of part of her work, then she meets Helmut Lang. And that relationship goes back and forth between what he's making and her, the structures of her work, maybe into her soft sculptures and using stitching.
Yeah,
and you
say she met Helmut Lang, but she was in her 80s when she met him.
Yeah, she's in her 80s. Charlie defines this moment when her husband dies, where all the attention kind of lay around her husband, who's a curator. And she moves out of that in various different ways, like through throwing off some kind of costuming, gaining new kind of costuming, making sculptural clothing that she then wears as a kind of performance. And that relationship is, somebody later on talking about fashion and clothing says that there's a freeing moment when it's made faster, fashion is made at speed and artworks often aren't. So there's that kind of exchange about sort of freeing from slower, slower making.
And if Louise Bourgeois is that high-end fashion, but with all of those memories kind of almost sewn into the fabric, if you like, some of the other female artists that he works, particularly mid-20th century artists, very different style altogether. English sculptor Barbara Hepworth, boiler suits, American painter Agnes Martin, overalls. Does he make any inferences about the fact that artists could do this at a time in the 50s and certainly in the 50s when other women just could not have worn clothes like that, really, I think?
Oh, he does. He talks about, laws according to what women could wear. Like in France, for example, you could wear trousers if you also were holding a bicycle. So you had an object that gave a context for the object that you were wearing. He talks about having to free the body to, and oftentimes he talks about artists changing the kinds of clothes they wore in the studio according to what the work required. So you wouldn't be able to reach high paintings or make large scale sculpture dressed in kind of restrictive clothing. But he also talks about the sort of ritual of wearing certain clothes to the studio and the patina and the paint kind of gathering and mounting up on garments, or the garment that's worn repeatedly into the studio. And it's sort of, he doesn't say it, but it's reminiscent of Winnicott's idea of the sort of transitional object, like a blankie, because it will hold on to all the kind of smells of the studio and the previous artworks. And somebody wears the same t-shirt for years and years. And there's a brilliant moment where somebody describes, she always wears Crocs outside of the studio, but she doesn't wear them in the studio because she's terrified all the paint is going to squidgy in through the holes in the Crocs. So there's that, you know, there's a lot of talk of things becoming uniforms and referring to labor, and a lot of hacking of other kinds of labor clothing into artists' wear.
How does he read David Hockney, who probably in some ways is as known for his clothes as he is his color, his clothes certainly being as colorful as his paintings are?
Yeah, I mean, the way Charlie Porter describes it, that the clothing was really a kind of gateway into color out of his rather drab hometown. And his he has a brilliant description, I might even read it, where he talks about Hockney's father, Kenneth, was a regular sight on the streets of Bradford, dressed in a three-piece suit with a bow tie, often decorated with paper dots to make them more lively. And Hockney says, he taught me not to care what the neighbours think. But obviously, the neighbours are the audience. You know, the father is working towards this audience that's right outside the door. And Hockney picks that up and starts wearing, you know, women's pink, shocking pink leggings, and decides blondes have more fun and bleaches his hair. And so that move, you know, it's a kind of gateway into being able to experiment with colour for Hockney.
Gilbert and George are in here as well, always in their, you know, formally dressed in their tweed suits, muted browns and greens, respectable middle-aged English gentlemen. But let's have a listen to a clip where they're explaining maybe the origins of their attire.
When our school was finished, no, and we were alone in this world, with not a no studio, because we were not rich enough at that time. So we started to walk the streets of London day and night. And we had to, we still believed we are art, no? And then we had this meeting decision that we could be actually the living sculpture, because we came from being sculptors, no? So we could be the living one, not the bronze one, not the marble one, not the plastic one, but the living one. And that was the beginning of the idea of Gilbert and George, art for all, living sculpture.
Interesting that that's Gilbert and George there talking about the origins of their, like, way of being, if you like. We're talking about the book What Artists Wear, the thing by Charlie Porter. Barry Claffey has been reading it for us. How does George, or Charlie Porter rather, approach this idea of Gilbert and George in the book?
That's interesting. I mean, a lot of, there's a kind of quietness. There's this very slight amount of comment that that sort of develops through the book. So he quotes from them. He says, we realize a lot of artists dress in an eccentric way or have an eccentric style, but they say that they felt that alienated 90% of the world's population. I mean, they're talking about a very specific world's population when they talk about the alienation. But he also goes on to say that George is a Tory and votes Tory. So there's a certain amount of that. So, you know, in a way, it's kind of lifestyle politics that they are expressing all the time. And he talks a lot about conformity and sort of this a slight twist on conformity and the power of that slight kind of twist and angle on something that's just the familiar turned around a little bit.
He also looks at, I suppose, artists, not unlike George, Gilbert and George, where the clothing always is like a costume. The photographer Cindy Sherman springs to mind here. Let's listen to her giving some of her ideas around this idea of how she used costume.
My work is not about kind of fantasizing about characters or situations. Some people, I think, have thought that the characters I do were, like as if I've always fantasized about being a femme fatale or whatever, you know, if in my film stills. I don't think of it as that literal to me. When I'm doing the characters, I really don't feel like it's some sort of something that grows out of my fantasy, my own dreams.
In college, when I would do it, I would, you know, become a character and then sort of think, well, gee, here I am as Lucille Ball, and what do I do now? So then it became sort of a thing and a little more like performance, and I started to do it to going to parties sometimes. I remember once getting all in character and wanting to go to some opening, and feeling like something was missing, and then I put a pillow under the dress and went as a pregnant woman.
Cindy Sherman there. And the kind of ideas, they're very important in my work, is among the things that she says to Charlie Porter in the book What Heart Is Where. But finally, very Claffey, does this book work, do you think, for somebody who doesn't have a very specific interest in fashion, or will it work for the broader readership?
Yeah, I think what's interesting about Charlie Porter's approach is that he uses clothing and dress and art and artists as a way to speak about the world in general. And, you know, this very intimate way that we use clothing, maybe as display, maybe as conformity, maybe in a way to sort of protest something. You know, alongside Cindy Sherman, he talks about Lynn Hirschman and how she makes another character, and dressing up in this clothing is a way to make this other character. It's also a way to talk about maybe some darker things, to talk about depression, you know, taking on this kind of costume. So it's, and there's, there, you know, what's very interesting about the way Charlie writes is that he tends to start with something quite early on, and then it ends much later in the book. So yes, there's lovely
weaves
rhythm
its way
to the narrative
it.
In it.
So yeah. this is worth getting, I think you're saying, and it's not that expensive in this paperback form either. It might sound with all those pictures as it would be. Is it worth getting? Would you say one word on it, Vary?
Definitely,
says Vary Claffey. What Hearts Is Where by Charlie Porter. It's published by Penguin. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Daniel Keating was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy.